Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about DigitalOcean, one of our incredible sponsors. They've got simple cloud hosting built for developers, and for all the code newbies who just started learning to code, yes, that means you, they've got one-click solutions for Rails, Django, Node, and much more, so you can launch your app in no time. And if you're looking for full control of your server, they've got that too. And if you use the promo code CODENEWBIE, you can get a $10 credit, so check them out and let me know what you think. We are continuing our conversation with the one and only Sandy Metz. Last week, we talked about her book, how she got started as an author, and what makes her such an incredible teacher of programming concepts. But we had a lot more to talk about, so here is part two of Pooter and Beyond. So I want to shift gears a bit and talk about you as a speaker, which I think is a little different.
Totally, than
writing and teaching. Mm-hmm. Have you enjoyed being a speaker?
I love speaking. Speaking is so easy compared to writing. Oh my gosh. I just love it. This is not a thing that would happen for me. If I could, like speaking, okay, it's very hard. It takes me a long time to put talks together. You know, often several, I would say almost never fewer than 3 months. Now that's not, that's not full time, but I often have, you know, 80 hours in the slide deck. Often I have three or four or five books, complete books read. And then I spend a month or two, where it'll be the second priority on my plate, working on the talk. And then I'll script the whole thing. I'll write down everything I think I'm going to say. And then I practice it front to back. The minimum number of times I practice a talk before I give it on stage is 10. So that's 10 hours right there usually.
Yeah. In front of like another audience?
No,
or just
I do it. I walk around in my room and wave my arms and rant and pause for the laugh lines for the jokes.
I do the same.
Kind of dorky.
Or just you look insane. Like if someone walks in on
you. You look insane.
It's awful. But
I mean, I feel like that's what makes. Okay. There's a guy named Scott Berkram who wrote a book called Confessions of a Public Speaker. And he put a metric in his book for how much effort you have to put in a talk. And it's this. You take the number of people in the room and you multiply that times their hourly rate. And that's what you owe.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we were talking a while ago, we talked about respect, right? How much respect, you know, what do you owe your reader? What do you owe the listener? And I read that early on in my speaking career, and it seemed, I mean, maybe it was just a convenient justification for my, again, inordinate amount of effort to put into talks. But yeah. So do you ever listen to, let me ask you this, do you ever listen to NPR?
I used to work at NPR.
Okay. And so you listen to, do you know Bailey White? Do you know Red Barber? These are back in the day. Tell me someone who tells little, you know, NPR has changed a little bit in the modern world. It used to be there were like mini little vignettes where people would tell stories. And that doesn't happen so much anymore now. Maybe on the weekends, right? On Weekend Edition. More like a This American Life thing, those little things. And I listen to those things and I think, wouldn't that be fun? All my life I've thought, that would be so cool. I could tell a story like that. I should tell stories. And I had no idea that I would ever be fortunate enough to get, to have the opportunity to basically tell people stories. And it's not the Moth Radio Hour, but that's what given a talk is, whether it's a tech talk or a keynote talk. Right? You're trying to reach up there and do something that moves people, that shares a common problem, that provides a solution, that's part of the human experience, that entertains and enlightens at the same time. And it is really fun. I come from sort of that redneck, blue-collar storytelling tradition where the greatest affection was shown by telling tales about each other. And I grew up in that world, and I feel like the opportunity to do it from a stage now, I feel so grateful for that. and really at ease with it. I was very don't get me wrong, I was insanely nervous the first time I did it. It was horrifying. But I got over being nervous pretty rapidly, and I just love being able to get up there and tell stories. Plus, it's so much easier to explain things up there when you have slides, and you can make tiny little incremental changes in slides compared to writing things down in a book. It's very hard to explain things in a book. Like in a book, if I put the same slide in there 20 times, 20 pages with tiny incremental changes in a picture, people would be up in arms, right? That would feel like cheating. But I can do it on stage. I can explain a problem by doing almost animations on slides. And people are it makes it very easy for people to follow explanations in a way that is very difficult when you're trying to do it with words in a book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is. So talks are much easier.
And to that point, I think that it's, you also have control over timing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because when you're writing a book and someone's reading it, they could be skimming it, they can jump around, they can skip. You have really you have very little control over how long they stay in a concept or how much they repeat it. And when you're talking, you can repeat it and it's normal, you know?
Yes.
You can pause, let it sink in. You can control the timeline a lot better.
Yes. I mean, it's just easier in every way. I mean, I don't know if that's true for everyone. Maybe some people would prefer to explain things in writing than explain things sort of by having a set of pictures and then talking. But I find it way, way easier.
Yeah. So you used to be nervous, and then now, I mean, I've seen you speak recently. We spoke together at Bath Ruby, and you were so comfortable. I was like, man, she's so comfortable. You made me comfortable. Like, I felt very comfortable. How did you get to that point?
I mean, part of it, two things happen, right? One is you just do it. You just do it. The first time you think you're going to die, you think you're going to get up there and they're going to eat you somehow, right? Some horrible dismembering thing is going to happen. And then also, I have a series of things I'm afraid of. Like, I'm afraid of tripping and falling as I walk up the steps to get on stage, right? Let's go through them. I'm afraid of taking a drink of water and choking. Getting that coughing, choking thing. I always have that. I'm afraid of spilling the open glass of water. If you watch me on stage, I never take an open container. I take a water bottle that I can put the cap back on.
That's very smart.
So I cannot, well, just because, I mean, in Bath, you were there in Bath when I left my Google Calendar up and a Google Calendar reminder came up. Here, let me tell this story. So I'm on stage. The screen is behind me. And I'm doing that thing I do. I had enough time so that I could, I knew I had in my speaker notes, I knew what time I had to be at a certain slide. And so I was a little bit ahead of schedule and I was allowing myself to kind of tell a few stories. And so I was telling a story unbeknownst to me during this sort of extemporaneous gab fest where I'm standing at the front of the stage talking to the audience, I'd had a Google reminder come up for a weekly meeting that knocked Keynote out. And remove my slides from the screen. And so everyone in the audience, 500 people know this, right? They're all looking. They're all looking at the screen behind me, but I do not. I am the only person in the room that does not know that my slides are no longer on display. And eventually I finally look around because I'm getting ready to change slides in it, and I realize that, Keynote's gone. And so then I have to, you're doing that thing that all speakers hate, which is the next thing, screwing around with the monitor. Right? Screwing around with the display. So I'm up there trying to like alt tab and figure out where did Keynote go and get it back up. It felt to me like it took forever, but I'm sure that it didn't really.
Fast.
It was pretty quick. Yeah. But then I felt like I needed to explain. And I just went out to the front of the stage and I told people, I'm so used to making mistakes. I've just gotten over it. And so part of it is you give enough talks and you find that here's what I tell newbies when I do a lot of mentoring of people who are getting ready, trying to get to talk for the first time. And here's my advice. If you are, they want you to do well. They're so on your side. You have that same experience, right? When you get up there, how does the audience feel? Tell me how the audience feels to you.
What I started doing recently is I'll do something like I'll say, if you can hear me clap once, if you can hear me clap twice, if you can hear me say, oh yeah, and just And it what I learned is when I hear them responding right in the beginning and I can see like a couple of smiles and just a little bit of energy from the beginning, it puts me at ease. And so before I used to do that when I would just start talking and like there was nothing happening on their end, I was terribly uncomfortable and very nervous because I just didn't know, like, are
when
you
they're sitting on their
angry?
Hands?
Are you angry? Yeah. And so just like starting, like doing a really simple callback in the beginning makes me feel like, okay, we're on the same page. We're on the same team. And,
like, you know,
and then
there.
I feel like they're on my side.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. So you feel uncomfortable without getting that warm up, making that connect. Like you feel like you have to, you make that connection intentionally. And lots of speakers do, right? Ben Ornstein does it all the time. Interesting. So I didn't do that the very first, I was not clever enough or experienced enough to even think to do that the very first time I gave a talk, but I was massively overprepared. And I just got in autopilot mode when I got on stage because I was so, you know, I there was nothing, you know, it was easy to do the right thing because I had practiced it so much. But I distinctly remember that feeling of enormous goodwill. You can feel it when you're up there. They want you to do well. They're really on your side. And I was very surprised by that. I thought they would feel scary, right? Like they were going to eat me or dismember me. You know, that I thought they would feel judgmental and as if a horrible thing was going to happen if I screwed up. But it was very much the opposite. It felt like they were incredibly supportive. I could really literally feel them rooting for me. And it might have been that I was obviously nervous. And so here's what I tell newbies. If you are well prepared and visibly nervous, it doesn't matter because they're so on your side. They want you to do well. Like everybody's very empathetic about that nervousness because either they're a speaker and they've experienced it or they're not a speaker. And part of the reason they're not a speaker is they find it so fearful that they can't. So people are very much on your side. If you're, however, if you are not well prepared, they do kind of want to eat you. Right? So don't, you know, you can't screw around with audiences' goodwill. You can't assume goodwill. But if you make the effort, it will be there. And so I was scared, and then I just got over it. I mean, it turned out none of the bad things happened. Like and now if I screw up, if the physical things, if I trip going on stage, or I spill water, or I cough, or Google tells me I'm supposed to be in a phone call and the slides go away, I'm much more likely just to laugh, because what do you do? Duh, right?
Yeah.
I also see, I had occasion when I got a new website put up last summer, and the folks who did it for me made little clips, little excerpts from my online talks. And they asked me to review the little 5-minute clips that they'd made. And I noticed something really dramatic then that I would have told you was not true, but I recognized when I saw it was true. There's a distinct difference in my visible onstage comfort level that dates absolutely from the publication of the book. And it's because in the Ruby community especially, which is a place where folks know me now because I feel like I'm theirs, right? I'm the Ruby guy and I'm the one that I want to, there's this whole world of OO stuff that's academic and hard to understand that I want to bring and share with my peeps. And their response to that has been so warm.
Yeah.
And I feel so well loved by this community that it has made me incredibly comfortable with them on stage. I commonly now go on stage and I like tease people a little. and that comes out of extreme comfort, but it's, I feel like I'm not everybody's mom, right? I'm sort of that age. I don't really want to think of myself as people's mom, but I want to be their like cool aunt. I want to be their
cool aunt. You can totally be my cool aunt.
Yeah. And so that makes it possible. Like part of it is the care I feel from the community being reflected back. That's what you see if I seem comfortable on stage, because I that care feels like I want to echo that back to them. And actually, Okay. Well, it's a thing about I'm already hedging. Gender. Let's talk about gender just for a second.
Let's do it.
And the only thing I have to say, I'm a tech person. I'm all tech all the time. I am the change we want to see. That's my goal. That's why I go on stage. That's why I write content. That's why I go out. However, the one thing I would say to women who are maybe listening to this, who wonder, who look at the sort of disproportion of representation in the community and perhaps wonder if there's a place for them here, what I would say is that I know that there's lots of different experiences, and I know everybody hasn't had the uniformly positive set of experiences that I've had, but I love this community. It's wonderful. Not only do I love writing code, like I love the work, but I love the people. And I think that I want to encourage all kinds of folks to come and feel as if they have a place in this community. And I wouldn't do that except that it's really cool and I love it. Now, it's not perfect, but it is way, way good. And I think there's no reason why everybody can't have the same experiences that I've had. Like I wouldn't want people to come if I wouldn't bring them to a place that was bad. Right. It's really fun. The work is fun and the people are great. And yeah, there are jerks everywhere. There's jerks in every line of life, right? There's no guarantee that you're not going to run into a jerk, but there's a place here for everyone, and I'm living proof of that.
Do you feel like you would have the same positive experiences if you didn't write the book and you weren't kind of a figure in the community?
It's hard to untangle those things.
Yeah.
I mean, what I would say, like, I never had a bad experience before I wrote the book, but I definitely was someone who, you know, I didn't know everybody. Like, I kind of know everybody now. And so I never felt ill-treated. I mean, there is a way in which part of the care in which people hold me is because of their... I feel like I'm being very positively paid back for the enormous amount of effort I put into. And mm-hmm. It's not about gender. It's about thankfulness for making the effort and doing the hard thing to pass something on. I loved the work and I loved the community even when I wasn't someone whose name you would have known. But it's definitely changed since then, right? Like, there's a way in which I feel like I'm in a mosh pit, I'm the one, right? Being passed around on people's hands in the sweetest, most careful possible way. But the fact that it can, the fact that that statement is true says a lot about the community we live in. Yeah, and so. I mean, before the book was published, actually, I had done a number of talks, and it had gotten to the point where people were stopping me in hallways at conferences, thanking me for the talks. But again, I mean, that's as a result of, I was not anonymous at that point, right? I was someone who had done made some effort to produce some content that people had found useful. But, there was a lot of... Like, there's constant effort on the part of the community to say thanks. And as on the receiving end of those thanks, it's a thing that makes the community, it makes it very obvious to me how incredibly generous this community is. Everyone should come. And everyone should write a book.
That's what you should Especially do. After you explained how wonderful that process was.
Well, that's going to suck for a while.
So I want to make sure we get some audience questions in from the community. So I want to go through those really quickly.
Okay.
This one is from Ben Helper, and he wants to know, how do new ideas and tech affect your approach, and what new idea has changed your development style the most?
Well, it's hard to have a real new idea. There's a lot of
everything's ideas. Everything's a remix, right?
Everything's a remix. I mean, many ideas that are new to me turn out to be old. You know, I mean, I'm, it turns out that I'm insufficiently educated to be aware of their prior existence. And so it's true that it's definitely true that I learn new things all the time and they change how I think of stuff. Most of these ideas don't seem all that new. I specifically in the last couple of years, you know, that functional programming has been such a big deal. I've been very interested in ideas of immutability and being able to get thread safetiness for free, basically. So I've been brain, like, especially the immutability thing. I've been writing, I adopted that with a vengeance in my OO code, and that's been very interesting, creating sort of that sort of Gary Bernhardt's idea of the functional core imperative shell. Michael Feathers talks about it. So new languages come up, and they affect maybe how you write code when you learn those new languages. The good ideas from other languages, we kind of steal them. They leak into our consciousness, and we use them. The talk I just gave at RailsConf brought a lot of comments from the functional folks who said, oh, this thing, the thing that you said, the nothing is something idea, is an idea we're very familiar with. We call it identity. And so that took me down the whole sort of functional identity rabbit hole. And I've spent a fair amount of time in the last month or two thinking about that and reading about that. So I don't know. I feel like I've made up so many ideas and then discovered that I didn't really actually make them up. And not only that, not only were they already well known, but they had names that I'm reluctant to say anything new. It's like the more we broaden our perspectives and learn about other kinds of programming than what we're familiar with, the more it affects our coding styles and the more we're able to deal with different kinds of problems. So I don't know. Ben, I hope that was a useful answer.
I think that was.
Felt kind of scattered to me, but.
No, I think that was really good. And I think that your point about you think you have a new idea, but then you realize that that's been around for a while and actually it has a name. Do you find that discouraging or encouraging? Like, do you feel validated because of that?
Oh, it's both, right? You feel incredibly smart because you made something hard up, and you feel completely stupid because you did it the hard way. If I just like paid some attention and read some things, if I was just better educated, I could have known. I mean, the problem, you know, the inverse is also true, right? There's a lot of times I am definitely familiar with the problem where people go get computer science degrees and they have book learning about all this stuff, but they have no idea what it really means and a complete inability to apply it in the right situations. You know, they know the names of all the patterns and they just use them randomly or don't use them at all. And so there's a way in which I've been well served by being uneducated and having to figure things out for myself, because I do have a very deep, deep, deep understanding of especially in OO, about why certain patterns are very good solution to certain categories of problems. But primarily it's because I figured them out myself and then later retrofitted the official explanations of those patterns onto things. And when I say pattern, I mean a big thing, right? Not like a gang of four pattern, but a way of thinking about or writing code.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, here's the problem, right? We can't. Very often it is impossible to understand the explanations of those things until you have struggled with them. And if you struggle with them diligently and carefully enough, you figure out the solutions. And then reading the official names and explanations can help tighten up your context about that later. But it may be that the only real way to learn things is to just go slog around in the mud and figure them out yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I think when I read Pooter the first time, I remember reading it because a lot of my classmates and friends had read it before they even knew Rails, you know, like just really, really in the beginning. And I thought to myself, but you haven't made anything yet. So how can there's no context of, oh, I really struggled with this and now doing it this way makes life so much easier. There's no kind of appreciation for that.
I find it very surprising that the book could be useful at all to people who had not struggled some with these problems. But at the same time, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it starts them off right a little bit. Like, whatever you can, like the loop, there's some weird spiral that's learning. And I find in my life, I revisit the same things over and over and over again at a slightly higher level. And so maybe it's all that way.
Yeah. Whenever I can, I try to read something or, you know, dissect a new concept at least 3 times.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I feel like there's a concept, I think it's called like the concentric circles of learning or something like that. And the first time gives me familiar with just the landscape and like the big, you know, the big words. And, you know, I kind of get an overview of what's going on. And the second time I start to really pick up, you know, and double down on some of the concepts. And the third time is when the things just really click and fall into place.
That makes perfect sense, right? Like I tell people, get the Gang of Four, what's the name of that book here? Let me just turn around and pull it off my shelf. Some design patterns book.
Yes.
That famous design patterns book. I tell people, just open the front and back cover and look at the names of everything. Because all the patterns are listed in there with a 2-sentence description of them.
And oh, yeah.
If you knew the name of them, and then next time you open it, flip through the book and look at every page. Just flip through and look at every page. Don't even try to read it. Just look at every page. And so you'll have a sense that there's a thing like this somewhere when you run into the problem. There's a thing. Oh, maybe it's the command pattern. Maybe it's the observer. Didn't I read a thing like that said something about a problem like this somewhere? Right, becoming familiar with the sort of terrain. It's like walking into a new landscape. All we want is sort of a map of the terrain. And I don't need to know what's at every compass point, but I do need to know that something, the trees are somewhere and water is somewhere. And you know, it's getting more detail about that is, you know, sufficient unto the day.
Another question by one of our community members is, this is from Whitney. Whitney wants to know, your words inspire me, but progress is slow in seeing and applying. What do you see as stages for code fluency?
Oh, Whitney. Okay. So that makes it seem as if there's a series of steps that you can walk up and that progress is only in one direction.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I would say that the more you know, well, let me speak just about myself. I learn new things almost every day, and I'm to the point in my life and career where everything I learn, it's like a light, it's like a candle, and the candle gets a little brighter, and it illuminates just how big and cavernous the cave I am is, right? I'm in is. And so you're not ever going to feel fluent. Well, maybe you'll feel fluent, but you're never going to feel like you know everything. What you do is you sit down and you write code every day. That's all you need to do. Just do the work. Show up every day and write code. And you will gradually know more and more. And the paradoxically, as you know more, the more you learn, the more you understand how much there is that you don't know. But the comforting side of that is that you don't feel so bad about it after a while. It's easy to, you know, you feel more comfortable that you know enough. Whatever you know right now is the amount you should know right now, and that the vast huge body of things that you can't know and will never know because it's just so big is just what it is. It's out there. You'll learn the things you need to know to do the work you need to do. And so just write code every day. I mean, I know when you're new, it seems as if everyone else knows so much more than you and that you will never catch up. But if you're having that feeling, what it means is that you're comparing yourself to the wrong people. And the thing that you should compare Very yourself to is the you used to be. And so the question you should ask isn't, like, do I know enough or do I know everything or am I smart enough or all these people seem, everybody I talk to knows something I don't know. And how is it that they're all so smart and they know so much more than me or they go so much faster than me? Really, the question you should ask is, how what do I know today compared to what I knew 10 weeks ago, 6 months ago, a year ago. And I think if you look at that, if you look at even last week or, you know, a quarter of your career ago, if you look back that far, whatever that time frame is, you'll find that you're astonishingly accomplished today compared to where you were then. And that's all it is. That's all there is. You just go forward. You do the work every day. You do small things every day, and the big things just happen.
Mm-hmm. I think a big part of what Whitney's saying, and I experience this all the time, is just feeling like I'm making progress, but I'm so slow. Like, yeah. Why did this take so long? How do you deal with that?
You get practiced enough at watching that happens, and to the point where you see that it's reality. And I think, I mean, here's the problem, right? It's a thing we talked about early in this conversation where everything you know seems apparent to you. And everything that you don't know seems mysteriously brilliant in the part of other people. And so the thing that, like, what does it mean to feel slow? You never feel slow in relation to yourself. You feel slow in relation to your perception that either somebody else could have done it faster, or you watch somebody do something you don't yet know how to do, and it seems very quick to you, right? You watch them. And they seem to accomplish some kind of miracle using some technology that seems incomprehensible. And when you look at them do it, you think, oh, I could never have done that, or certainly I could never have done that in that brief a time frame. But if you invert that equation, all it means is they know something you don't know yet. And so slow is almost a word that doesn't have any meaning. You know, slow is only so that even using that term to describe it only makes sense if you're judging yourself against some other person that knows something that you don't know. So by definition, it's just something you don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. You know, just slow, get over it. I mean, the other thing is like this whole thing about making, you know, like we make mistakes for a living. This is our job. Mm-hmm. You write some code, it's wrong. 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 You write some code, oh, it's right. And what is the next thing you do? You'd go to the next thing. I write the next code, it's wrong. I write the next code, it's wrong. And so this tolerance for being wrong, like you have to have a very high tolerance for being wrong. It's odd. Like I can't think of another business like ours where you're always working on a new problem that you don't know about in a new domain that you don't know about. And you're primarily writing code that's incorrect. Like who else gets to do this for a living? Just fail and fail and fail and fail and fail and succeed. And fail and fail and fail and fail and fail. And so, I mean, the thing I would say if you're like, don't be stressed about being slow. Accept that as part of the process of writing code, that it's kind of our job. By definition, if you knew how to do it, you would already have done it. You'd be done, right? The things that are fast happen quickly. Mm-hmm. Like the only things that you notice are the ones that are slow, right? The things that you don't know how to do. And so, yeah, it's just, that's our business. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Just do it.
So next, let's move on to some rapid fire film. Oh, actually, one thing I realized is I don't think we ever actually defined what object-oriented design is. Do you mind giving us a quick definition?
No. So my definition of object-oriented design is your code has a design, and that is just how the structure of it once you're done, right? You have an application, you put in object-oriented design, you're going to make classes and objects, maybe modules. You're going to break the code up into some kind of name chunk, and you're going to arrange them to interact in some way. That's design. Now, I realize that's a very workman-like definition, but really that's all that matters. So design is how your code looks when it's done. So if you're writing code in an object-oriented language, basically it means what classes and methods you have when you're done, right? Because that's what we do when we write OO.
And definitely read the book and you'll get all the details and the unpacking of all that stuff.
Yes, if you're ready. And if you try and it seems incomprehensible, just put it down. Come back to it later when it makes more sense.
And you can still look Sandy in the eye afterwards.
You can make eye contact with me whether you read it or not. Indeed.
Next, let's do some rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Okay, sure.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
Someone once told me that a thing was not for me.
Oh, what are they talking about?
Unrelated to tech. Unrelated to tech, but it was a thing. It was a goal for people like me, a goal that people like us don't do that. And I would tell you that that's always wrong. If you get that advice, if you get that message from anyone in your life, you can just ignore it. Everything is for you.
Nice. Number two, my first app was about.
I'll tell the listeners that I got these questions came to me before this podcast, and I actually cannot recall. It was
what?
So long. It was so long ago.
Sandy, I'm so disappointed.
I can tell you this. It was. I'll give you a choice. It was either the elevator licensing system in the state of Florida. You know, you go in an elevator, you see those little permits mm-hmm. that tell you like how much weight can go in an elevator. It could have been that. We did a thing about this disease that cows get that they get tagged called brucellosis. You can see, you can tell these were all for state government systems.
Yeah.
But it was a really
it's
long,
very official apps.
Very official. It was a very, very long time ago. They were all written in COBOL and they ran on the mainframe computers in Tallahassee, Florida, in state government. Yeah. So yeah.
Okay. Well, I pick the cow one.
You pick the cow. You know, the elevator licensing thing was actually quite cool.
Yeah.
But the cows, yeah, they were both good though. That's okay. Not the kind of real, there weren't San Fran startup apps. Let me just say that.
No, definitely not. Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
You know, I didn't have a good answer for that a while ago. I would have said, my first thought was to say, I wish I had known how much fun it was going to be. But the truth is that I knew the very first program I ever wrote that it was going to be fun.
Nice.
You know, so I it didn't take long for me to find that out. Yeah.
When did you first start to code?
In the early 1980s. I think I had my first real job in 1981.
And did you study computer science in school?
I did not. I was a music student, and then I went to Votech School, which I don't even know if they still exist. This was back when you really could not get a computer science degree.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I punched, I won't play that game, that one-upmanship game about how, what kind of archaic computer I first started on, but I will tell you that I punched cards on an IBM 370. That's how we,
oh wow,
we, you would go to a little machine and make cards and take them into the operator to run your program. That was back in the day.
Huh. So how did you go from music to coding? It seems like a pretty big jump.
You know, it turns out there are lots of musicians that went into computers. I was at Florida State, and it was clear that music wasn't going to work out for me. And I was just looking for a way to make a living. And I knew someone. I mean, that was back when, I think this is probably still true. Like, Votech schools are where Votech schools tend to teach programs that employers in the community ask for. So if there's a business that needs skilled workers that can't hire them because there aren't enough trained ones, then Votech schools teach that stuff. And so this was so long ago that computers, mainframe computers were exploding, but they couldn't get enough people to write code. I know it seems incomprehensible now, right? They couldn't find enough programmers. And so the vocational schools taught coding. They taught data processing, they called it. And so I went out to the Votech school because I wanted to get a skill that would let me find a job. And I ended up in the computer, you know, in the programming school. And on the morning of day one, I wrote a Fortran program. And I was hooked at that moment. Like, I never looked back. I so loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It was so amazing. That first, I mean, can you remember the first computer program you ever wrote?
I think I wrote a frog app. Which doesn't sound nearly as cool as a cow app, but...
Well, but the very first tiny little program, not app, but just the very first time you sat down at a computer and made something go.
I think it was the tic-tac-toe game that we had to write as part of, like, the boot camp application. I think that was the first, like, full, not something more than, like, a math problem.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so, did you feel exhilarated, amazed?
Once I got it to work, yes.
But
what was interesting to me was, you know, the first time I wrote it, it was an embarrassing number of lines of code compared to, you know, the problem that it was supposed to be. And I refactored it like 4 or 5 times and mm-hmm. got it down to something much more respectable. Mm-hmm. But the first time I wrote it, I remember thinking, man, I put so much brain power and time and, you know, tears into this, and the game ends so quickly when you actually play it.
It didn't seem quite worthwhile.
Right. I was like, man.
Oh.
But no, it was very magical. It was incredible to see, to like look at it, and it was a command line to Datto game, and to look at it and to say, like, I did that. Like, I made that.
It seemed like magic, right?
Yeah.
Truly. Yeah. It's cool. I loved it.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Yes, I do. Two. One is completely non-technical, and one is a thing that I've just been interested in lately. And so one's very topical. I've been reading. I think I need to know more about JavaScript. I do.
I feel like all Ruby developers are saying
that. Yeah. Well, I think everybody who writes code probably now. You know, mm-hmm. who knows what's going to happen in the world, but I think we should. And so I've been looking up the 6, right, the new ECMAScript, mm-hmm, script, mm-hmm. And thinking that being interested in how the CoffeeScript syntax has been a little merged into it, like I think I'm going to find it more palatable. And so I read, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, but the website is RAUCHG, I think, .com.
Mm-hmm.
Here, hang on. The link will be in the show notes. And so there's a wonderful description, a great blog post about the differences that has a million links in it to articles that give you good reasons why. And I found it fascinating. I spent all day last Saturday just following links and getting further and further down the rabbit hole about JavaScript 6. And so I think if you don't know much JavaScript yet, maybe you should just skip right to 6,
mm-hmm.
and use the transpilers to do it. So we'll put those links in. That's one shout out. The other thing, I was on vacation last week and spent a week without a computer.
Whoa.
And I think...
That sounds terrifying.
I think, exactly. Now, I'm a woman of a certain age, so I remember before before the World Wide Web. I remember way before cell phones. Cell phones seem like a fairly recent innovation to me. And so I lived probably half my life in a world that was fundamentally offline. And I went to the backcountry of Utah last week and spent a week where I didn't check Twitter or email or anything. I didn't take a computer. I took a phone, but I didn't have it on in the backcountry. I think if for people who have the same reaction you just had,
mm-hmm.
it's a very interesting experience to get unwired for a little bit. And maybe you can't do it for a week, but I think everybody out there should experiment with walking away from the computer, even for 24 hours, just to maybe think, to figure out what reality feels like without that kind of constant wiring. I mean, there's a little dopamine rush thing going on, but there's also focus and insight and deep thoughtfulness available away from the multitasking world. And so one of my shout outs is for normal reality. And I think everybody should try a little dose of it away from the computer for a day or two. I know that's probably odd advice coming from me since we all live on the computer. I know it. I'm not criticizing, but it was shocking to me how difficult a time I had adjusting. And I think that folks maybe should try it.
Yeah. So when we got married, you know, six months ago now, we did a week in San Diego, and I think I was pretty good about not checking my phone or my email or even opening up my computer. Babe, is that right? Did I look at my computer that week?
What'd he say? Now we all want to hear.
He said, don't make me say what actually happened.
Yeah.
I was very proud of myself. I did a surprisingly good job, mm-hmm. of not being, you know, on Twitter and on email and generally not working during that week. And I was surprised at how much more peaceful I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just being able to say, you know what, this is my week for me and, you know, my new husband, and we're going to just have fun together, and we're going to do all great things. Like, it was just really nice to be able to detach and let go. And I agree. I think there's just a huge amount of calm and zen that can be attained by that.
Well,
and then you got to get back to the real world.
I've also found it just the opposite for me, right? I realized how an instant of boredom makes me reach for my phone.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, in the old days, people had to find some way to entertain themselves. Like, what would you think about if you couldn't distract yourself with the phone? And if you don't put it away, you never know. And so I was a little startled last week. The difficulty I had, the initial difficulty I had adjusting, and then I had to think about, why is this, right? Why is this that I always want to reach for my phone? What need am I filling? What activity did I used to do instead? What would my life be like if I had that mental landscape back? I think we would all maybe, I don't know, it would be good for us. I felt like and not only is it focus and peace, but it's also deep thought and insight. And I think that the devices that we're using to help us achieve those things may be interfering a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I feel like that should be a goal. Like, let's have a couple hours a week where maybe we don't check Twitter.
Yeah.
Maybe we just put it down and we just think.
Maybe you put the phone away and take a walk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't take the phone with you on a walk. How hard would that, would that hurt? Would that be painful? Would that be scary? I mean, it is. I know a lot of people who can't be away from their online. You know, they can't pull the plug out of their brain for that long.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should maybe. I think we should fix that. I don't think it's good for us. We should stop that.
So for our sponsored shout-out, DigitalOcean's offering the Code Newbie community a chance to try their cloud hosting service. Use the promo code CODENEWBIE and get a $10 credit to get your app up and running. They've got easy one-click solutions for Rails, Django, and much more. And if you do try it, let me know. I'd love to know what you think. So I've got a couple of shout-outs of my own. The first one is your talk, which I'm glad you didn't shout out because it means I get to shout it out. Which is Nothing is Something. And it's I think you've given this talk maybe a few times.
The best version is the most recent version from RailsConf, the improved version.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have the one from BathRuby, which I thought was amazing. I actually really liked that the calendar alert happened. I really enjoyed that because it was like a little break.
Oh,
you know?
My goodness.
It was like saying he's one of us, you know,
totally.
Which is always comforting. So
very
I liked it.
So.
You should do more of that.
Oh, so I should plan one? I should schedule it instead of turning those things off when I'm giving talks? Okay. I'll take that under advisement.
but Nothing is Something was really, really good. And I remember a couple of my coworkers who saw that said, you know, I knew about the null object pattern, which is, you know, what that talk was based on, and like I'm very familiar with it, use it a lot, but man, the way she explains it just makes so much sense. And these are, you know, very experienced programmers who walked away feeling like they learned something.
That's cool.
And I think I think that says a lot about the talk and just about you, Sandy, in general as a speaker and a teacher. So definitely check that out. Another shout out that I have is called A Beginner's Guide to Making a README, which I really, really like. It's on the Changelog blog. And what I love about it is, you know, it kind of takes you through a series of questions to ask yourself as you create a README for your project, whether it's open source or whatever it is. And it says, you know, what does your project do? How is it set up? How is it used? Is it in good shape? And these questions seem very simple, but you'd be surprised how few READMEs actually address them and answer them. And when I was looking, you know, when I think about Pooter and kind of the general message of good, you know, writing good code, a lot of it is maintainability and extensibility, but a lot of it is also just communication, like being able to tell other developers who are looking at your code what you mean and being able to pick it up very quickly. And a README is a very important part of your code base as well, especially if you're looking to get collaborators or contributors. So definitely check that out, and I'd be curious to see how your own README measures up. So if you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Sandy, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Oh, thanks. It was my pleasure. Yeah. Bye, doll. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.